This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Tom, Rich and Brandy on a Thursday morning in Ramadan. And a lot to keep us busy. There is, of course, that bridge collapse in Baltimore. We've been speaking to a man who knows a thing or two about a boat. Captain Zarir Irani is Managing Director of Constellation Marine Services. He's been speaking to us about what it means for, amongst other things, insurance and supply chains. We've been looking at ADNOC pumping at the Belbzam oil field and what it could mean for the amount that we get out of the ground here in the UAE. We've been looking at a possible IPO for the construction firm Alec. That's with Ziad Awad, who is the founder and CEO of Awad Capital, asking not just what kind of appetite we could see for this IPO, but what a construction IPO would tell us about where we are in the property cycle in general. And the Louvre is back above pre-pandemic visitor numbers. We've been speaking to a man with a fantastic accent for radio, Manuel Rabate, their director.
And the lead story, I have one word for you, Belbzam.
Love it.
Had anyone heard of Belbzam this time yesterday?
The gates of...
I'll see you at the gates of Belbzam.
No, it's a Harry Potter book. Harry Potter and the Prisoners of Belbzam.
It does sound very sci-fi or fantasy. It is, in fact, a oil field. The Belbzam block is expected to rise to 450,000 barrels per day of light crude. And, get this, 27 million standard cubic feet per day of associated gas. We know this because this is the new oil field that ADNOC has announced yesterday is now working. We've heard from the boss of ADNOC Upstream, Abdulmunim Al-Kindi, and he says the start of crude production is, quote, testament to the success of our strategic partnership with CNPC. That's China's National Petroleum Corporation. And he goes on to talk about the robust bilateral energy relationship between the UAE and China. So happy days. Well done, ADNOC. 45,000 barrels a day. I mean, it's not going to move the needle for Abu Dhabi. What is it? It's, you know, 2 or 3% of Abu Dhabi's production. And it's 1% of their target of 5 million barrels per day. So it's an incremental change rather than a game changer. But my question is, why? When OPEC Plus is slashing production to prop up the price, and when we're all transitioning to goodness knows what futuristic fuels, including in Abu Dhabi, why do we need Belbzam?
Because ADNOC has its own targets to increase production. Because we had Haitham Al-Gaith standing up the other day and saying we need to keep investing in fossil fuels to keep the lights on. Those voluntary cuts from OPEC extend into Q2, but they don't go on forever. Well, as of yet.
No, fair point. There we go. Well, that's answered that. I agree. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate. I agree with you. There's reasons that ADNOC has a very long-term strategy to increase hydrocarbon production because transition has to happen gradually. We've heard these arguments before. Like you say, Haitham Al-Gaith of OPEC speaking this week, wasn't he? We didn't talk about that quite as much as we probably should have done, did we?
I think we didn't, because OPEC boss says, let's put money into getting energy out of the ground is not a headline.
You see,
dogs suggest let's dig up more bones. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those headlines. Business breakfast presenters say we should make more coffee. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I do, except I partly take a slightly different view in that it is in the interest of OPEC and big major producers like Saudi Arabia to discourage the world from increasing in oil and gas production, because who will be the real winners if the world does fail to invest? It will
shale.
Be...
Are we going with this? The price?
No, we as in the Gulf, the lowest cost oil producers in the world, would be the winners if shale or offshore Angola did fail to invest, because in 15 years' time, we'll be all that's left and we'll be sitting pretty. So actually, OPEC Secretary General saying the world needs to invest in more oil and gas production, is Turkey's voting for Christmas? my economic logic is not, it's not winning me over. Fair enough. We'll let that one lie. But Baldasm is now up and running. So well done to the team at ADNOC in partnership with China as well. A big focus on IPOs this morning. A couple of stories, really. We've got the potential IPO of Alec, the construction company. You're talking about that a little bit later on. But also this story about EFG, the investment bank, putting a lot of its manpower in Saudi Arabia for IPOs.
Yeah, I mean, we've interviewed people before from various consultancies who are increasing their Saudi headcount. This is a Bloomberg story, speaking to the guys from EFG, the investment bank, saying, yeah, we're going to put more people in Saudi. There are more deals and we're expecting more deals.
Other stories we're looking at this morning. Tom, you've been looking at the economic implications of the Baltimore Bridge. Serena Kelly's going to give us an update on what's actually happening with the bridge at the moment. Of course, the human loss of lives is first and foremost, but you have been looking at the business angle.
Yes, big port. And it's basically closed at the moment whilst the recovery work continues, and of course the structural, making the structure safe, so there is no traffic going in or out. That's going to have a massive impact, or is it going to have a massive impact? Is it going to affect us? Question's going to put to Ronnie in just a bit. Captain Zarir Irani is joining us live here in the studio, and he will be giving us his take on the event itself, how it happened, and the knock-on effects as well. So looking forward to hearing from Captain Zarir Irani. Will it impact the American economy? Is there going to be a knock-on effect to our economy? Are we going to have the old S&C supply supply and demand, supply chain issues that we've seen in the past? Is that going to raise its ugly head, especially given what's going on in the Red Sea and the rerouting of a number of tankers at present? So that's all coming a little later on. He's going to be joining us a little later this morning, in fact in the next 10 minutes or so. So we've got all sorts in the building at the moment. Sorry, Serena and I were a little distracted during the news because big name celebrity walked past you.
I didn't even turn around.
I didn't notice that at all. It's like the basketball court with the gorilla, isn't it? We were too busy shooting hoops to notice the gorilla.
You guys just, you were locked in to all things news and things like that, yeah. But the Egyptian silver fox made his way into the building. Bassem Youssef made his way past. Said a big hello to the business breakfast team. And you ignored him, you lot.
He's a good guy, but he's the John Stewart of the Middle East, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Yeah, no, he's brilliant.
Or John Stewart is the Bassem Youssef of the United States.
Yeah, and Serena's dressed accordingly.
Serena Kelly is with us in the studio from the ARNU Centre. Serena, joking apart, thanks for staying with us. You've got the latest on some of the big stories. We'll get to the some of the big local stories in a second, but first of all, Baltimore.
Yes, so after the cargo ship crashed into a bridge in Baltimore on Tuesday, and obviously everybody has seen that incredible footage as well of the bridge falling into the water below, authorities have been trying to locate six people believed to be working on the bridge at the time, reportedly trying to fix potholes. So they found two. They recovered the bodies. Here is Maryland State Police Superintendent Roland Butler.
Divers located a red pickup truck submerged in approximately 25 feet of water in the area of the middle span of the bridge. Divers recovered two victims of this tragedy trapped within the vehicle.
So four people are still missing. Divers have been trying to search vehicles trapped beneath all that wreckage of the collapsed bridge. But they're saying the waters have become quite treacherous at the moment, so they've had to suspend efforts for now. They did manage to recover the black box from the ship yesterday. Now, the cargo ship, the Dali, was leaving Baltimore en route to Colombo, Sri Lanka. None of the 22 crew members were hurt. It lost power before colliding with the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And apparently, the same ship was involved in a similar incident. So it happened in 2016 in the port of Antwerp, Belgium, when it hit a quay as it tried to exit the North Sea Container Terminal. So in regards to the Baltimore situation, it could have been a lot worse. Turns out audio of emergency workers reveals they tried to stop traffic just before the cargo ship hit the pillar.
One of you guys on the south side, one of you guys on the north side, hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering.
So they actually managed to close the Francis Scott Key Bridge before the disaster, but they didn't have time to evacuate those construction workers. Eight plunged into waters where temperatures were 8 degrees Celsius. So two rescued, two bodies found today, four still missing. Terry Jones drove across it moments before it fell into the water.
Like, I was an actress in a movie, and I just was standing there, and I was like, it's no way that this is happening. I seen that boat, and I was like, why are the lights flickering off and on? I've never seen a boat of that size, of a capacity, that close to the bridge like that.
I do have figures for you, but I know you've got your upcoming interview where those will probably be discussed as well in detail.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much indeed. More details?
Just check out the Area News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Fears have been arisen, concerns, if you like, have been raised of a ripple effect on global supply chains after the container ship crash into a bridge in the US city of Baltimore. What impact is that going to have on the US economy, the global economy, on shipping routes as well? Let's get the thoughts of an expert in this field, a Lloyd's Register Advisory Committee member for the Middle East and Africa, past president, global president that is, and current director, regional director of the International Institute of Marine Surveying and IIMS board member out of the UK. The managing director of Constellation Marine Services is Captain Zaria S. Irani. Captain Irani, thanks so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom, having us again.
Every single news outlet around the world is, with good reason, carrying the stories of the Baltimore accident and incident. For those that are still a little bit sketchy about what happened, or not so much what happened, but how it happened, how did it come to be that a ship, a large tanker, a large supply tanker coming out of a busy port collided with a bridge? What's your understanding? I appreciate that investigations are ongoing.
Thank you very much, Tom. This is a container ship, and container ship carrying about 100... it was a 938 feet long, almost 300 meters. And although it looks full, she had a lot of empty containers on board. And these empty containers actually were coming back to China. And that's what happens in the supply chain. Usually ships look, they're loaded, they're with empties coming back to China. And saying that, this vessel was a relatively large vessel for the transit route. The bridge was built way back when ships were 20,000 gross tonnage. This was 100,000. To be honest with you, it was a big ship. It was a big elephant moving its way, and it's lost its path and had an elision, not a collision. It had an elision with one of the...
An elision?
Yes. It was not a collision, which most of the media houses are saying. In our investigation terms, it is an elision. Usually these bridges have a concrete ring around them to defer such large vessels coming in so that they don't go and hit the sensitive structures, which is what is today's protocol when these kind of bridges are built. And that, I think, is a very important consideration. Had that been around the structures of this bridge, I don't think the bow would have made an elision with this.
What's the difference between an elision and a collision?
Elision is just
a clips,
yes. And that, if you see the pictures aftermath early morning when they were taken, it's the bow edge, just the flare of the bow, which is just clipped on the pillars, and that's what brought it down.
Obviously very dramatic and obviously very tragic elision into the bridge. The bridge has been completely destroyed. I mean, the reconstruction of the bridge, we tell you, is going to go north of $600 million. But what about the knock-on effects for trade? Obviously, we've got those tanker, we've got those containers on the ship itself. But as you said, the majority of those are empty. But we also know that trade into and out of what is one of the busiest ports in America is, for all intents and purposes, shut at the moment. Yep. Is that going to have a knock-on effect?
Yes, it is, of course. It is, first of all, going to take a week or two to get the debris out, because unless and until there is a proper dredge survey done underwater, inspection of the seabed, they wouldn't open the channel back. That means Baltimore port is shut. And as what I understand, it is one of the very large ports which imports a lot of cars into the U.S., particularly from the European continent. And that definitely is going to be deferred, delayed for a very long time. And that's going to have a logistics effect on a lot of Korean cars coming into the port. It is one of the largest importers of imported cars, and that's going to be having a knock-on effect with supply chain delays.
You mentioned the busyness of this port. You know, Baltimore, the busiest port in the US for car exports, the ninth busiest for foreign cargo as well. Not insignificant, that's for sure, in the top 10 of ports across the United States of America. What happens to a port, a busy port like that, when it basically shuts down for business until further notice?
Well, lots of claims, for sure. A lot of people lose a lot of money due to delay, and they look to try to pass it on to whoever caused this delay. Of course, the backlogs take months to clear. We saw it when the Suez Canal was blocked by the Evergreen vessel. Saying that, in my view, it is never going to be the same again, because this bridge is going to be at least 2 to 3 years before it can come back. And most of the workforces on the other side of the bridge, they'll have to come around, and there will be delays. And even if they do come around, there's not going to be much movement in the port for at least the next couple of months, if not more.
So impact on the local and the regional economy, obviously, for Baltimore. Knock-on impact for the U.S. economy as a whole, especially when it comes to car and other exports and imports. What about the global economy? Will it have a knock-on effect? Obviously, we know that there is pressure on the logistics and shipping and maritime industry at the moment. Is this the last thing they needed?
Yes, this is definitely the last thing they needed. Listen, these elisions and contact with bridges have been happening for years. There have been not so serious, but incidents around the world, which we have all the time seen, I would say at the rate of one every couple of months. They never get so serious. We've got bridges up in Dubai, and we see small boats having elisions through them and getting on with life. Point being that currently, the way the global economy is, with the Red Sea routes being strangled, the Panama Canal with having a drought there, not being as efficient as it is, operating only at 40% its capacity, and now this important route or a port being blocked, it definitely will put pressure on the supply chain globally. And it's more isolated, may I say, as compared to the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal, what it was last year, 2 years ago, whenever it was. It's going to be more focused, a bit more concentrated on the east coast of the U.S., so to say.
But as you predict, you reckon that the lawyers of Baltimore might be busy men in the coming
already,
months?
Already, I think, looking at very expensive properties and looking at nice, expensive holidays already. They must be rubbing their hands and thanking their stars. But I would say that most prominent lawyers in and around Baltimore and the U.S. jurisdiction would definitely get busy on this one.
We will watch this space, that's for sure. Captain Irani, thank you so much indeed for your take on this one. Thanks for your expert insight into the latest out of Baltimore. Those are the thoughts of Captain Zaria Irani, who's the Managing Director of Constellation Marine Services.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Bloomberg's been reporting that there are early talks about a possible listing for the construction and engineering firm ALEC, which is part of the stable of the Investment Corporation of Dubai. Very pleased to be joined now by the financial advisory. There's an awful lot to do with deals, mergers and acquisitions. Ziad Awad is founder and CEO of Awad Capital. Ziad, it's lovely to speak to you this morning.
Morning, Brandy. Nice to be back on the show.
Right, let's have a look at whether or not ALEC would make sense for an IPO. Before we do, do you want to just remind us where ALEC fits into the construction landscape?
Well, ALEC is really one of the crown jewels of the engineering and construction ecosystem in the UAE. It was acquired by ICD around 7-8 years ago, and they've been growing since then. They're known for their strong management team and landmark projects. And I think it would be, you know, an ideal IPO candidate, given the strong demand we're seeing from investors generally for the sectors of engineering, construction, and the building materials.
Okay, so there's two things there. Let's look at what might make it a good candidate for an IPO. What about ALEC itself as a company do you think makes it a contender?
Well, the sector itself is not an easy sector, and I would start really from the top down, going down to the company itself. But what we're seeing right now, and that's really my starting point, is a very strong demand in the sector, very good performance, which is driven by the population growth and the government spending, and some of the issues we've had in the past really being behind us. Then when you drill down into the UAE, in this sector, ALEC does stand out. And as I mentioned, where it stands out is the landmark projects it has executed, the strong management team it has, and obviously the backing of a first class shareholder, which is ICD.
Does it rely though on that property boom continuing? You mentioned the sector first there, which is interesting in the outside environment. How much does the IPO interest in ALEC depend on the external environment still being buoyant?
You're right that the market is a very important backdrop to the IPO of a company in such a sector. And I say this because exactly the question you're asking is the property sector. We know it is a cyclical sector. It does go through booms and busts. And so when investors consider an investment in a cyclical sector, they have to be mindful that the valuation reflects that cyclicality. So a business in engineering and construction, for example, which is gonna definitely go up and down with the cycle, should not be valued as aggressively as a countercyclical investment, for example, in healthcare or in education, which are what we call defensive sectors and countercyclical, and they see generally ongoing stable demand, which is really based on the existing population, as opposed to, for example, new developments and new projects for an engineering or construction company.
What will people be looking at, though, in terms of ALEC's own books? I mean, people will think engineering construction firms going public, and the obvious comparison will be Arabtech, fair or not?
It is true that ALEC would have a steep hill to climb after the delisting of Arabtech. What investors should be looking for in ALEC, like in any other company going public, again, is a strong management team, strong financials, which include both the P&L and balance sheet. On the P&L side, you want to see solid gross and net margins, and on the balance sheet, you want to have a look at the receivables and any debt that is out there, because at the end of the day, it's really financial debt that can be the biggest enemy of equity value, which is what investors focus on as they look at their share price. The receivables part of the balance sheet is also extremely important, as the sector is known at times for delayed payments. So when you get that bust part of the boom and bust cycle in development, if developers start being late in their payments, this impacts the contracting and engineering companies, which in turn hits their balance sheet and their share prices. So given the market is in good shape, we would want to see a solid balance sheet for any IPO that's going public in this sector at the moment.
What about the margins in the sector?
This is a sector which is known for its low margins. The profitability comes more from volumes and mass, and that's what's exciting about the region generally at the moment, is the massive amount of development that is going on, and the pipeline is still very, very significant across the region, particularly in UAE and Saudi Arabia. So there is a significant number of mega projects and companies in this sector will be benefiting from that. They'll benefit via higher revenues as well as higher margins, because the margins actually are partially a result of supply and demand. So when there is an exceeding amount of projects with limited amount of quality ability to service that these projects, those good companies in the sector which have a good track record and a good promise to deliver to their clients will be able to command higher margins.
Well, you advise on an awful lot of deals. You'll be pricing up a lot of merger and acquisition targets. How much do you think that ALEC could be worth?
You can't put a number on it without actually knowing their profitability and their revenues, which are not public information. What we could speculate, and really it's just speculation, is what kind of multiples the company could price at. And again, it's speculation because we have not studied their results or their financials. But we'd expect a solid multiple in the double digits, i.e. above 10 times earnings.
Who would you expect institutionally to be interested in ALEC, an ALEC IPO, particularly on the international and institutional side?
The institutional demand, both regional and international, is increasing in the stock markets of the region. The international demand into the UAE is not as strong as we would have liked it to be, given a number of corporate governance issues in the past with some of the listed companies in the region. But with the Federal Reserve expected to cut rates around the middle of this year, this typically increases the interest in higher risk assets, and that includes emerging markets equities. So we do expect, and I do expect, to see more international institutional interest in regional stocks and regional IPOs. And I would say, I would not highlight a specific type of investor, but I would say we benefit from the investors who follow the MSCI Emerging Markets index, which we are part of, and I would expect those investors to participate and potentially, depending on the valuation, because they're also very valuation conscious, try to go above a little bit above what the index would indicate.
Ziad Awad, founder and CEO of Awad Capital, speaking to us about a potential ALEC IPO. Thank you for your time.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
So, Tom, we're going to be crossing live to Abu Dhabi in just a few moments' time, aren't we? Because the Louvre pulling in the punters. It's never going to be a kind of Dubai Mall style mass tourism thing, is it? And no museum will be, but they've well above the million punters a mark, a million punters a year mark now, aren't they?
They are indeed, yeah. Over a million visitors. In fact, we can find out more about this because latest visitor numbers have been published from Louvre Abu Dhabi, which of course has been attracting visitors since it opened its extraordinary doors and developed the space down there on Saadiyat Island. Let's cross down now live to Abu Dhabi, where we can catch up with the director of the Louvre Abu Dhabi. Manuel Rabate joins us now live on the line. Good morning to you, Manuel.
Hello, good morning. Good morning, Tom.
Great to have your company this morning. And congratulations on your visitor numbers for last year, breaking through the million Thanks. Visitors mark. In fact, actually smashing it. 1.2 million visitors. Was that above expectations?
Yes. Slightly above expectations. And you have to understand that this 1.2, which constitutes all the visitors to the museum, plus all the activation that we are doing around the museum, it's more than when we were doing before the COVID time. So this is really a groundbreaking and it's double the digit that we had last year. So we're really back on track on a very strong trend.
Where are the visitors coming from? Is it majority tourism, or do you attract a significant number of residents?
It's actually fairly balanced number. We have 72% of our visitors that are coming from all over the world as a tourist to the UAE, and they would come from India, from China, from Russia, from all over the world, actually, to be quite exact. So 72% are people who are visitors of the UAE, and 28 are actually residents coming from the Seventh Emirate. So, of course, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, but all the full UAE are visiting us. And when I say resident, I mean, of course, the Emirati, but everyone who calls the UAE home. And within this number, a very important one, which is for us, education. And education numbers represent 45,000 school kids and university students who are visiting the museum last year.
It is an iconic structure. It has become a cultural landmark. How do you keep it globally significant at the moment? It's interesting to see how many officials and dignitaries visited during 2023, giving an indication it is one of those things that's put onto the agenda when dignitaries come to town. But they come to town fairly rarely. In order for you to maintain that footfall, you mentioned the word education there. Is it important to bring schools, to bring learning establishments to you?
This is completely the core of the mission of the museum, to let's say, elevate yourself. So you can do it as a tourist or as a resident visiting, and you can be in contact of the history of the world through our masterpieces, and that would change. But for the education, we're working even more. We're trying to get the extra steps, being in the curriculum, making sure we can work with a teacher. We offer a great program called the Schools Takeover or University Takeover, in which they own the museum for a day, and they can propose a program which makes sense for the education itself. And I think it's really absolutely key. I would say that to maintain this level also, Tom, if I may, it's about the building, which of course is iconic. Mm. It's also about the narrative, the collection, the masterpieces, the one that we own in the UAE, in Abu Dhabi, and the one which are on loan from the French Museum, from the international partners. I think it's all about the exhibition as well. Last year, we had 5 incredible exhibitions. We had Bollywood, we had Letters of Light, which just closed the Cartier, which was at the end of last year, which started before, picturing the cosmos specifically for the, talking about education, specifically for the family, art here with the artist of the region. So you see, there is always something new to see at Louvre Abu Dhabi.
And in terms of keeping that balance, because you mentioned there about the new exhibitions coming in, there might be a headline Picasso piece that is being hung, etc. or other, that grabs a number of people's attention. But you've got to keep the permanent collection. How do you keep that balance to maintain the interest and the significance?
The key word is exactly the one you use, balance. It's about keeping the consistency of the narrative. So we are the first universal museum of the Arab world, which means that we are telling the story of the world here in Abu Dhabi, in the core of the Arab world, and we are doing it by bringing artworks of the finest quality and connecting them. So this is what we do, and this is what we keep always doing. But we're doing with artworks which are moving. You mentioned the Picasso that we acquired and we exhibit last year. We have the incredible painting by Leonardo, Saint John the Baptist, on loan from the Louvre in Paris. We have coming next year an incredible masterpiece of Islamic art coming from the Louvre, the Pixid al-Mughrabiya. So we have all these elements which are rotating. So the core is always this story, but tell in a different way. And the programs are very, very active. There is always a great international standard exhibition going on at Louvre Abu Dhabi. So it can be focusing on the Indian storytelling and as we did with Bollywood. It can be the discussion between the faith and the tolerance with the Letters of Light. And just now we have Kalila Wadimna, a new exhibition talking to the families through fables.
Manuel, just to lower the tone, I am the sort of person who goes to an art museum and ends up in the gift shop, and I've managed to leave the Louvre with 2 bottles of perfume, actually, from a local niche perfumier, Amner al-Habtour, her Arcadia. How much competition is there from brands and companies and products to get into the Louvre gift shop, and how do you choose who you stock?
I'm smiling because it's definitely part of the experience. I really think there are many ways to enjoy a museum, and and the souvenirs that you will bring, the restaurant you will have a break or coffee or a fine meal, the fact that you can you can do a tour of the Louvre in a kayak around all these experiences are part of what it is to be in this very special and civic space that is a museum. So indeed, the bookshop, the gift shop, is curated as well. And yes, there is competition because it's not just about souvenir. It's souvenir which have to have a cultural insight. So the Louvre Abu Dhabi is not exploiting directly, managing directly the boutique, but we are talking with people doing it all the time to make sure that they get the best product in line with the exhibitions. So for instance, for the Children's Museum, the exhibition currently is about space and picturing the cosmos. So you can be sure that in the gift shop there are many ideas of gifts that could work for kids, educational, but also in connection with a space theme.
Manuel, we can't thank you enough. Thanks so much indeed for your time this morning. Thanks for joining us live from Abu Dhabi. Congratulations on those visitor numbers for 2023, already into 2024. And I know for a fact that already the visitor numbers looking very good down there in Louvre Abu Dhabi. That was Manuel Rabate, who is the director of Louvre Abu Dhabi, joining us live here on the show.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.